Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by one of the sponsors of this program, Fred Flights, the president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. Fred, as you listeners know, is a career intelligence professional who has extraordinary service to his credit in the government of the United States, notably as a CIA analyst for some 20 years, working in the State Department, the House Intelligence Committee, the National Security Council in various capacities, including as Chief of Staff to Ambassador John Bolton. We are always appreciative of his time and very glad to catch up with him at a busy moment, catching him on route to a Fox News interview. Fred Flights, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back. Fred, you wrote a piece on the 9th of January that I have the feeling Mike Pompeo might have been channeling a little bit yesterday in remarks that he made at the Hoover Institution. Let's first of all start with your own thinking on what Donald Trump has accomplished with the elimination of Qasem Soleimani.
Well, the president took out a notorious terrorist who was responsible for the deaths or maiming of thousands of Americans, killing over 600, maiming thousands, and killing thousands of Iraqis. And it now turns out the president made a decision months ago that if U.S. citizens' lives were lost, he would retaliate with force. And one of the options he had was to take out Soleimani. And it's interesting to see the response by the Iranian government, this missile attack. Now, look, I've studied Iranian missiles for years, including with the center. I know their capabilities have vastly improved. Iran could easily have inundated American military bases with hundreds of missiles, but it fired about a dozen, most of which missed, meaning either they fired the less capable missiles or they were capable missiles and designed not to hit. And why? Fear. Because they fear the United States. They fear President Trump. President Trump forced Iran to blink. It said it was going to carry out acts of retaliation, but it was afraid to kill American citizens because it was worried what President Trump's response would be. And look, I've said before on the show, a strong United States is stabilizing. It's good for international security. We did not have that with Barack Obama, which led to this disastrous nuclear deal with Iran, with Russia walking all over us, the president setting up a world order that I think is promoting our national security and promoting international security.
This is interesting, Fred, because there was a report on National Public Radio yesterday, I think it was, that a reporter was on the ground at one of these bases that was attacked by the Iranian missiles, and that the facility in which our personnel were operating drones was actually devastated by this attack. Fortunately, I guess the heads up that had been given to the Iraqis by the Iranians that an attack was going to be coming enabled us to get clear of the area and secure our people. But it does sound as though there was sufficient accuracy and sufficient intention to disrupt the actual military operations of those units, if not actually harm their personnel. Do you know anything about that?
Let's bear in mind that the Iranian government warned us this attack was coming, both through channels with the Swiss government and with notice to the government of Iraq. Now, I don't dispute what our military has said. This is still an unacceptable attack that put American lives at risk. But to say this was a serious effort to kill Americans or to do serious damage to these bases, in my opinion, that's just not true.
And now, Fred, the Secretary of State at the Hoover Institution put, I think, your thought in a slightly different context, and I'd be very interested in your reaction to it, both in the narrow context of Iran as well as other capitals where we face adversaries who may have come to the conclusion of late that our deterrent is inadequate. Mike Pompeo talked specifically about restoring deterrence. Have you had a chance to look at his comments? And if so, do you find him very much aligned with your own thinking on this?
I have. I think he's exactly right. And he is fleshing out what America First means in terms of international security and how and when this country will use force. It'll use force to defend U.S. national interests, not to start unnecessary wars, not to extend unnecessary conflicts in American deployment. But the president wants America to be strong, believing that peace through strength, that's the Reagan motto of his national security policy, is the only way to secure our freedom and security. And I think the president demonstrated that when he took out Soleimani. You may remember on Fox News after the missile attacks on U.S. bases, friends of ours, Republican congressmen and senators, were saying, well, let's level Iran. Let's take out their nuclear sites. Let's take out their oil refineries. President Trump does not want to do that. He does not want to start a war. He doesn't want to do that unless it's necessary. So I think this calibrated response establishes deterrence without starting a new war.
Fred, in the course of your distinguished career, notably at the CIA, but in various other capacities as well, you have closely studied North Korea, for example, under successive despots there, the Kim dynasty. You've also, of course, been closely involved in high-level policymaking with regard to Russia and China. What do you think about the argument that there were signals being sent to those capitals as well as to Tehran by this decision to restore deterrence?
I think that that restoring deterrence and the signal of American strength was a very powerful message delivered to all American adversaries and enemies. And I imagine that that leaders in Pyongyang were watching this very, very closely because they're used to basically the American presidents and leaders acquiescing to North Korean threats, giving them what they want because we just want a deal and we don't want to risk a confrontation with North Korea. So I think this was very important.
And I think it goes without saying, but let me just emphasize, each of these governments in Pyongyang, in Beijing, in Moscow have, to varying degrees to be sure, but each of them have fairly close ties with the mullahocracy in Iran. So even if the message were not meant directly for them in their respective capitals, the fact that it was having such a therapeutic effect on the government of Iran would not be lost on them as a result of that indirect relationship, I assume.
I think that's right. There's also the unpredictability factor. These rogue states don't know how or when President Trump will respond. He's been very patient. He's had many opportunities to respond militarily to Iranian provocations. And I think some of Iran figured there would never be a response. This is a very powerful response, and it's going to send a message to terrorist groups and other U.S. adversaries and enemies that this country will respond militarily in a powerful way if our citizens are put at risk.
Fred Flights, thank you so much for your time and for your extraordinary experience, service to our country, and insights. We look forward to talking with you again further next week. In the meantime, Happy New Year to you. Stay well. Next up, Michael Cutler joins us. We'll be talking with him about the challenges we're facing from American policies that may be intensifying the threat of enemies within, like Hezbollah. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by a retired senior special agent of what was once known as the Immigration and Naturalization Services. His name is Michael Cutler. He is a prodigious contributor to the public policy debate through his writings, often at Front Page Magazine, and also, of course, his own radio show, the Michael Cutler Hour, heard Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. It's always a delight to catch up with him, even though oftentimes what he has to share with us is grim tidings indeed. We expect nothing less but the truth from him and are happy to welcome him back with a happy new year to you, Michael. Good to have you with us. Listen, speaking of the truth, I wanted to address with you today the topic that you took up in Front Page Magazine recently entitled Iranian Terror Threat Exacerbated by Sanctuary Policies. We'll get to the sanctuary policies in just a moment, Michael, but level set with us. What do we know about the presence in the United States of Hezbollah and other Iranian-associated terror cells and sleepers and otherwise, I guess you might say, terrorist organizations?
There are terror cells operating in the United States. Peter King, when he chaired the House Homeland Security Committee, at a hearing stated, look, we know of at least hundreds of terror cells operating in the United States. And for those folks who don't understand what a sleeper or a terror cell, you said sleeper, by the way, not cell. But if you want to know what a sleeper is, because that term is out there, maybe some people don't understand it. I'll explain it easily. It's an alien who, no matter how they get here, they maintain a low profile. So when people say, you know, if someone doesn't have a criminal history, but they're here illegally, why should we arrest them? You need to maintain the integrity of the immigration system, and you must never overlook the possibility that that person who's not been arrested, in point of fact, is here endangering national security and public safety nonetheless.
Amen. And that would be true in spades, I would think, of terror cells that are associated with, well, the late Qasem Soleimani, for example, the Iranian Revolutionary Quds Force and Guards Corps commander. What do we know about their presence in the United States specifically?
Specifically, we know that during the re-election campaign of Barack Obama, we had a situation where the Iranian Quds forces, at the direction of Soleimani, were attempting to assassinate the Saudi ambassador. And they were using, by the way, drug cartel members in the United States to do it as their proxies, being directed by Iranians who came across the border. Let's understand that for decades, Iran has been sending Quds forces at the direction of Soleimani directly into Caracas, Venezuela. Venezuela used to be the wealthiest country in all of Latin America. It is now the poorest country. They have destroyed the country. They, the communists, Iran, the others who are the enemies of the West, they infiltrated the Western Hemisphere. We know that there are terror training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil abuts with Argentina and Paraguay. And they've been sending aliens into the United States from the Middle East through Brazil, where the potential exists that they've been going through training camps. We also know that Caracas, Venezuela provides identity documents to people. They're authentic paper, but they're improperly issued to people under assumed identities. So this is all going on, and we've had numerous sleeper agents arrested in the United States. Most recently, an individual who came here in 2000, a year before 9/11, became a United States citizen, was arrested within the past couple of weeks by the FBI and Homeland Security. Homeland Security is a division of ICE, by the way. And they found on him photographs of potential terror targets that he was scoping out inside our country in New York, Washington, and elsewhere. This is an immediate threat to our safety.
It is an immediate threat. It is a present danger. And what you've written about at Front Page Magazine, Michael, is that the policies of certain communities and states is exacerbating this danger. Talk about the sanctuary policies and their effect on such threats from within.
Understand, and you know, no politician should be able to not quote the 9/11 Commission report. The all clear hasn't sounded. And you know, here in New York, we've got the politicians saying, we're going to protect you from the sleepers. We've got the cops out there with long guns. Meanwhile, we're providing driver's licenses to illegal aliens who can't verify their identities. When our forces raided the bin Laden camp, they came away with the training manual that instructed the trainees, the terror trainees, to create a minimum of 5 fake identities for themselves. A driver's license is, in point of fact, something that we as professionals call breeder documents. Because with a driver's license, you can open a bank account, you can get a membership card in all sorts of organizations. You can build a fake identity that looks credible and legitimate, and you gain access to office buildings, whether it's government, corporate office buildings. And by the way, and this is the thing no one talks about, or two things they don't. Number one, I don't know the last time they used an airplane, terrorists used an airplane to carry out an attack since 9/11. The conveyance of choice for terrorists around the world have been what? Motor vehicles. The bombing at the World Trade Center in 93 involved a rented truck, and you need a driver's license to rent a truck. Let's think about that. Rented a truck. illegal alien, rented it. He was here on a visa that he had violated, so he was now illegal. The guy who drove the truck and parked it in the garage, another illegal alien from the Middle East, parked the truck, set off the bomb, killed six, almost brought the tower down, injured over 1,000 people. We saw on the west side of New York 2 years ago, 8 tourists from Argentina mowed down by a truck rented by a terrorist. So this isn't a big secret. We all know that this is a method of attack. It's also a method of surveillance. Most of the terrorists who work in the country get jobs as, you know, driving vans and taxis and limos. Why? Because they can hold clandestine meetings with the so-called passenger in the back seat. They are as ubiquitous as trees in a forest. They could scope out locations. They can hold clandestine meetings, and they could then use the vehicle as a means of attacking. And the one irony I have to point out, you know, for all the talk about the environment, giving millions of illegal aliens driver's licenses will put millions of more drivers and vehicles on the roads, which creates more pollution. So the hypocrisy is mind-boggling, and we're told by the left, oh, the immigrants, and we're not talking about immigrants here, folks, we're talking about illegal aliens. The immigrants never commit crime. They may drive without a license. They may drive drunk. They may commit identity, but they don't commit crimes. You mean to tell me that driving a motor vehicle drunk and without a license isn't a crime? So the lunacy that we've been spoon-fed by the media and the politicians is mind-boggling.
Michael, let me go back to something that you wrote at Front Page Magazine back in December, which is relevant to all of this, and that is a prime example of disarming our law enforcement personnel who are in the front lines, as you were for decades, in the protection of the American people. And specifically, you were reporting on how New York State is now blocking the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau and Border Patrol from having access to the Department of Motor Vehicles database in the state of New York. What is up with that? And give us again, what are the implications?
So think about it. It's not just New York. It's New Jersey. It's other states around the country. They are telling Immigration and Customs Enforcement, we're not going to let you know who owns that vehicle. So we use that motor vehicle computer at ports of entry so that if a car comes across with a New York tag, the inspectors who are vetting the vehicles coming into the country know if it's a stolen car, know if that license plate doesn't relate to the vehicle. They can't do that anymore. And I can tell you that when you do surveillance, if you're trying to go after smugglers, human traffickers, drug smugglers, terrorists, it's important to know who belongs to the car. If you go into most cities today, they have license plate readers positioned on poles and on the back of police cars. That's how critical motor vehicle information is to identifying terrorists and criminals. So if you're doing surveillance and vehicles show up at a location and people are being dropped off, it could be a smuggling ring. Maybe they're trafficking in humans. Maybe it's women being forced into prostitution. You run the license plate, it comes back blocked. If you need the information, you have to get a court order by a judge and submit it in writing to the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles. And when they get around to it, they'll respond. This is the biggest gift that these states have ever could have given to sleeper agents, to human traffickers, to drug smugglers, to gang members, and to people who are a threat to everyone's health, safety, and survival. And they're doing it under the umbrella of we're being compassionate. Compassionate for whom? To handcuff law enforcement. And by the way, most people don't realize the second largest contingent of law enforcement officers who are assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force are immigration agents. Think about it. Every alien who engages in an act of terror, whether it's preparation for one, surveillance, they are violating the terms of their admission into the United States. They commit multiple violations of immigration law. That's how critical immigration law enforcement is. But let's be honest. We only have effectively 2,000 to 3,000 immigration agents for the whole country. Neither party wants true immigration enforcement. The key to the immigration crisis is not only the wall on the border, which we do need. The real issue is interior enforcement, and we've never had that from either party because they want the system to fail so that they can bring in cheap labor, foreign students, foreign tourists, and for the immigration lawyers on both sides of the aisle, it creates an unlimited supply of clientele.
Michael Cutler, we spoke yesterday with Rosemary Jenks on a very similar line, and she made the point about particularly interior enforcement being enabled by E-Verify as a mandatory means of just giving people situational awareness about who we're dealing with, who's coming into this country, what are they doing? You're talking about a lot of other things as well, obviously.
Yeah, but E-Verify, everyone asks me about it, I want to be clear. It should have been mandatory from day one, but if you don't have agents, it's worthless. Because I used to raid factories before I went to the drug task force. You can have 45 time cards on the wall, and you go onto the factory floor, and there's 596 people. Guess what? They've got 48 people on the books. They're legal. Everything is fine on paper. They look like a model company. But without agents to go to that company and conduct that investigation, you have no idea that there are a couple of hundred people working off the books. That's, again, why the politicians don't want the agents, because even if we create mandatory E-Verify without the agents, it's like having IRS without any auditors to make sure you're not lying on your tax return.
You've given us a lot to think about here in terms of the presence in our country of sleeper cells and other terrorist entities, the ability of those entities to be activated at will, their ability to do incredible harm to our country, and the degree to which we are denying ourselves lawful, available means to try to protect the American people against these threats. It's just unbelievable. And your warnings, Michael Cutler, are deeply appreciated, both those you have been issuing regularly on testimony before the Congress and, of course, on Front Page Magazine's pages and your own Blog Talk Radio program, as well as here. I hope you'll come back to us often in 2020. Thank you, my friend.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and I'm very pleased to say welcome back to an old friend and colleague from the Reagan years in the Defense Department, among other things. His name is Chuck DeVore. He has been active in both public policy and in the arena of ideas for decades, notably as a assemblyman in the state of California for a time. These days, he is the Vice President for National Initiatives at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. But he has been contributing mightily, not least through his role as a member of the Army National Guard, through whose ranks as an intelligence officer, he rose to the level of Lieutenant Colonel, in which he now resides as a member of the United States Army Reserve, retired. He is a good man and a great resource whose column at Forbes magazine recently caught my eye, and I wanted very much to share it with you. And to do that, I'm very pleased to have him with us. Chuck DeVore, Happy New Year to you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you. Let's talk a little bit about what you sort of led off with in terms of this provocative piece. And that is a topic we've been discussing a bit on this program for several years now. But I'd be very interested in your thoughts on it. The so-called social credit system that Communist China has been developing and apparently will institute fully in the course of 2020 for their own people and apparently be exporting to others as well.
So the social credit system, it's kind of like your credit score here in America, although it's very important to understand that the sole purpose of it is to keep the Chinese Communist Party in power. So they're harnessing technology, they're harnessing sensors, facial recognition, artificial intelligence, to keep track of their 1.3 billion citizens in China. And so, for example, if you do things like, you know, take care of your elderly parents, you commit a heroic act or something like that, or you praise who is now called the people's leader, General Secretary Xi, you get credits for that. Demerits could include things like running a red light or practicing a religious faith or even cheating on online games. And so what they're doing is they're basically automating the surveillance state by using sensors and 5G technology and artificial intelligence and facial recognition so that they can more or less automatically keep track of everyone. Now, of course, if you're a high-ranking Chinese Communist Party official, I'm sure those demerits wouldn't count against you until they do, right? Until perhaps they need to purge you, at which point all the things they've been saving up could be used against you. But that's the idea behind the system. And it really brings into existence, it brings into life the very concept of totalitarianism, meaning that there's nothing outside of the state, right? The state cares about the total human existence, your thoughts, your words, your deeds. Everything is within the purview of the state.
So, Chuck, as you look at this, it sounds like Orwell on steroids, I have to say. And the prospects that this might be applied to the Chinese people, including Christians, for example, or Muslims, or Falun Gong, or Buddhists, or Tibetans, is bad enough. But you're talking about it being applied to everybody in China. And then this being a product that can be employed by totalitarians or wannabe totalitarians elsewhere around the world. It seems as though this is an extraordinary threat to freedom, not just in China.
Well, it is, and certainly in various authoritarian regimes in, for example, Southeast Asia or in Africa. This certainly allows them to extend state control and surveillance into every aspect of people's lives. Now, I have a bigger concern, which is that now that China is getting great practice at the social credit system, in other words, practice at integrating technology and artificial intelligence and facial recognition into determining who has been bad for the Chinese Communist Party and who has been supportive, right? So that technology has tremendous uses outside of the realm of keeping control of populations. It has military applications, national security and surveillance or espionage applications as well.
Talk a little bit about that, because your title of the piece at Forbes was really provocative. How Made in China Threatens Privacy, Civil Liberties, and National Security. So how does this omnivorous data collection and sensor and evaluation technology get weaponized?
Well, let me give you kind of the ground level example. So Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher has warned about the fact that our government hasn't taken cybersecurity really all that seriously. And what he was talking about were just run-of-the-mill things like printers and Wi-Fi-enabled cameras and laptops that have been made in China that were commercial products that were bought basically on a credit card and brought into the Pentagon and other very sensitive agencies in Washington, D.C. Now, these devices, it's been found, have been compromised with back doors. Now, in those cases, you have to have an individual basically access the back door, an individual out in China, and they can do things like, for example, look at the camera feed. They can look at printers and see what was printed, right? Laptops, of course, open up an entire range of things. Now, that's child's play compared to what we're about ready to see with the social credit system being integrated with the system of systems, with 5G, with zero latency, and artificial intelligence and facial recognition. Because at this point, imagine, for example, a Tesla that has very sophisticated sensors, it has cameras on it, it's going to be connected to 5G, it's autonomous. You could potentially have the ability to have Teslas that are connected to 5G be integrated, whether knowingly or not, with Chinese AI and facial recognition systems, such that they could serve as surveillance platforms, that you could know, for example, where someone was. And in an extreme case, potentially take control of the vehicle and use it as a weapon to injure or kill somebody, or to tie up traffic on a road, you know, where perhaps the president's motorcade is a few miles behind and you want to disrupt the ability of the president or some other important person to get from point A to point B. So, you know, this technology is wonderful. It's great. It's going to improve our lives. However, we really ought to be listening a little bit more to people like Representative Gallagher and Senator Josh Hawley, who have expressed some concerns about the downside of big tech.
In response to Mike Gallagher's warnings and that of others, I gather that the Pentagon has been cleaning up its act with respect to these Chinese supply chains, has it not?
They have been. However, I think it's very important to understand that with 5G, the game has completely changed. Once you roll out that 5G net, and heaven help us if Huawei is allowed to have any piece of it or has a piece of the net 5G with some of our allies, especially the Five Eyes allies like the United Kingdom and Australia, because that opens up the possibility that it will be even more difficult to keep our secrets secret, number one. And number two, it's going to allow the potential of having all of these devices that are connected real time with no latency to have some of them turned into surveillance devices and some of them be able to act in ways that could be physically harmful, that could, for example, damage the grid or cause a machine to purposefully malfunction and cause a, for example, a natural gas pipeline to go down. So the opportunity for mayhem, the opportunity for damage, I think goes up dramatically. And especially when you connect it with artificial intelligence, because at that point, then you don't necessarily need 5 or 10 people in some hacker farm working to access these devices. You can essentially automate it. You might even be able to install the malicious artificial intelligence program on a server farm in the United States itself, just sitting there waiting to be activated when it's told to.
This is, of course, a combination of several critical technologies you've mentioned, Chuck DeVore, the 5G network. We certainly don't want to see that established in this country, or for that matter, elsewhere, without security baked into it and independent of Chinese Huawei or other companies that are tied to the People's Liberation Army. The Internet of Things, which it is supposed to power, has certainly got potential to the use of 5G to execute orders from elsewhere, inimical to the interests of the individuals or, for that matter, the country in question. Where you are taking us with all of this, though, is that this social credit score system and the technologies and the mastering of them that the Chinese are doing is really creating a whole new battle space for our country and for others in the days ahead. Do you sense that our own national security establishment is alive to these dangers and is responding in a timely way?
Well, I certainly think they might be alive to some of the segments, all right, to some of the individual components, as you saw with Congressman Gallagher's criticism and the Pentagon's response, which was entirely appropriate. The thing that concerns me immensely is that the social credit system in China is something akin to the Apollo Moonshot program for cyberspace. It is a system of systems that is so vitally important to the Chinese Communist Party, because the whole purpose of it is to keep General Secretary Xi, People's Leader Xi, in power forever, to keep the Chinese Communist Party in power forever. So they are sparing no expense, no intellect is being spared in applying and in knitting together these systems to be a powerful system of systems that is like nothing we've seen before. And that is what I'm concerned about, that we haven't yet woken to the threat that this new thing presents. This is something that no one has seen before, and it has applications way beyond China and way beyond the social credit system.
We appreciate your early warning on this, Chuck DeVore, especially your visiting with us about it. I hope you'll come back for a longer, deeper dive into both what the Chinese are doing in this respect and much more, because I think you're right, this is not well understood, let alone being properly countered, and we need to get on that right away. This is a project for 2020. We look forward to joining with you in that regard. Chuck, thanks for the work you do at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. I hope you come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Christine Douglas Williams about the Trump derangement syndrome in Canada and the dangers of an Iranian fifth column operating there. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am thrilled to say we are joined for the first time in the new year, but also for the first time in altogether too long, by a woman I admire greatly who lives in Canada. Her name is Christine Douglas Williams. She has been an extraordinarily accomplished and internationally recognized journalist and television producer, 9-time award winner to be precise. She is also a former federal appointee with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation and a woman who has contributed mightily through publishing in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and a number of other quarterly and publications of different kinds on and offline. She is also the author of a book at the Center for Security Policy Press, I'm proud to say, Fired by the Government of Canada, for criticizing Islam. She is also the author of The Challenge of Modernizing Islam, and always a welcome guest here. Christine Douglas-Williams is her name. Thank you for joining us, Christine. Good to have you back. So, Christine, one of the reasons that I wanted to speak with you is that we, of course, were treated the other day to a screed by a fellow, I think it was on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken, by the name of Michael McCain, who is apparently a prominent Canadian business executive. I personally had never heard of him before. Tell us a little bit about him and then about what he unleashed with his critique of Donald Trump over this takedown by Iran of a Ukrainian airliner.
Now, Michael McCain, okay, he is the chief executive of Maple Leaf Foods. This man is highly prominent in terms of being a businessman, because according to the Canadian Business Magazine, actually, he's among the top 100 richest Canadians. And what's so upsetting about what broke in the news is when people like him use their influence to make these political comments. What he said, actually, and it referred to the downing of that jetliner. He said, quote, "I'm very angry, and time isn't making me less angry." He actually referred to Donald Trump. He didn't actually mention his name, but he referred to him as, quote, "a narcissist in Washington." What he did was criticize him also for his attack and for the killing of Soleimani. Now, when you look at what took place here, this is a terrible tragedy that those individuals lost their life, okay? 176 passengers and crew were on that jetliner, and there were 57 Canadians. But to use that tragedy to actually become politicized. Now, the reason he was upset was because one of his colleagues, one of his workers, lost his wife and a child on that flight. There were a lot of lives lost, which, again, is very, very tragic. But what this man is inadvertently doing by putting his mouth in where it does not belong into a horrible battle now that's going on, and this is a long time thing going on, not just between Iran and the United States, but between Iran and the free world. They are a top funder of international global terrorism. So what McCain is doing here is enabling a bloodthirsty human rights abusing regime. He seems to have forgotten that Iran murdered in cold blood some 1,500 of its protesters in the street since November, and those murders actually took place within a two-week period. It has resurfaced because protesters are fed up. They're seeing what's happening with the regime. They're anti-regime, despite what the far left has to say, and despite all the opinionators and those who are using tragedy to advance the democratic agenda. Now, what I found rather interesting is that recently, Ricky Gervais, who is a well-known celebrity himself, when he was speaking at the Golden Globe Awards, he said, don't use it. He cautioned the celebrities there. Don't use this platform to make a political speech. But here you find this fellow that is the head of a meat-making company using his political platform to make a political speech. What is even worse, coming from a Canadian perspective, is the influence of Iran in Canada.
That's what I wanted to turn to next with you. This fact that he's got a meatpacking plant, I wonder whether it's true on your side of the border as it is in the United States, where there seems to be a high percentage of individuals who have come to this country, either as refugees or as immigrants, who are working in these plants. Many of them, as it happens, seem to be from Muslim majority nations. Is that the case in Canada as well? And could that have some bearing on Mr. McCain's unhinged attack on Donald Trump as the man responsible, at least in part, for this outrageous takedown of a civilian airliner by Iran?
People are angry out there because they see it as Trump is the one that is stirring up trouble with these rebels. Now, these kinds of people, the jihad, these jihadists, they have no scruples. These are bullies. And one would think, even in the West, that we would have learned by now the concept of a bully. You appease a bully, you give in to a bully, it only becomes stronger. When you look at immigration in Canada, it's pretty much the same as we see across Europe. Now, I'm not talking numbers. No, not at all. We don't share that kind of a landmass. But what I'm talking about is a globalist leader that is openly welcoming. In fact, when Donald Trump talked about, announced his decision to ban the 7 Muslim countries, these were countries of interest, actually, that were selected by Barack Obama, countries of interest in the best interests of the United States. Immediately, Trudeau tweeted out, "Welcome to Canada, where diversity is our strength." And we saw an unleashing, particularly at the Quebec border. We saw people coming in there by the droves. Nobody knows for sure how many people have entered the country illegally in Quebec, that Quebec border. But we do know it's tens of thousands of people, most coming from Islamic countries. And they're coming from the United States, but it's interesting that investigations have been done that most of these people coming in were not in the United States for a long time. They heard that welcome. They managed to get over to the United States and stay there for a very short time before making their way across the loose border of Quebec. Also, something that was uncovered by Breitbart within the last year was that they discovered that our intelligence, CSIS, it was revealed that CSIS said we had a bigger problem with jihadists that was made public previously. Not just that, but it is very difficult to prosecute jihadists and those that were fighting for the Islamic State, simply because there's no system in place.
And by virtue of the fact that there is this porous border, people there can always be back here at will.
Yes, yes. And what you just stated there is very important to the next point about the effect of Iran in this country expanding its fifth column. First of all, I'm going to say something it's quite alarming, because this turned up this past summer where there was a member of Hezbollah's external operations group. It's actually known as Unit 910. There was a member of it, Ali Karani. He was found to be collecting detailed information about Toronto International Airport, and it was revealed they were planning attacks here. Now, in 2012, we must remember in Canada that the Iranian embassy was discovered to be expanding a fifth column in Canada with calls to eventually attack the United States. And they were doing it through their cultural program that was also influencing campuses, university campuses across the country. And it was subsequently shut down by the former Conservative government of Canada under Stephen Harper. Problem is today is that we have an MP, Majid Johari. He has been consistently lobbying for Canada to reopen its embassy and to re-engage with Iran. And recently it came out that he's been getting money from Iran and that he's really basically an Iranian thug. This is what's been going on. And this man is a member of parliament. Now, when you look at what's going on in Canada, when you look at that kind of infiltration and that kind of call, we're having a bad problem here. And the McDonnell Laurier Institute Canada Iranian lawyer warned that the Iranian influence in Canada is a real concern, and that the very goal of Iran is to create conflict. Now, when, again, going back to the comment from this man from Maple Leaf Meats, this is a fellow that has influence. A lot of people do not understand the intricacies of Iran. They don't understand about the Iran deal. There is still a notion out there, which actually he talked about, the same McCain fellow, that Donald Trump ended up ruining the peaceful deal through the Iran deal. That was not a peaceful deal. That did not keep Iran peaceful one bit. In fact, it was uncovered because Israeli intelligence discovered an elaborate plan that Iran had where it was building up its nuclear arsenal. And in a heat of rage against the UK, Khamenei this summer admitted that they had gone above the limits. And he actually threatened, "We will not stop building this up. We will not stop violating this pact." He admitted that, Khamenei.
Christine Douglas-Williams, we could go on and on. We appreciate your visit as well as your great work. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us often in 2020. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.